My life as a loser. In my childhood and early teens, I spent many happy hours at the Winter Club, a casual family club whose most unique feature was an outdoor artificial ice rink. The rink provided hours of free ice time, where as a child I learned how to do crossovers and rudimentary spins. Entering my teenage years, Friday night free skates were an important social opportunity, the first totally innocent and spontaneous co-ed event. Everyone would play pom-pom pull-away, a game where you tried to dash across the ice and evade the tags of the it people. The girls would pay close attention to see if a boy preferentially sought them out for tagging. Girls would also wear long stocking caps to make it easy for the boys to snatch their hats, giving rise to a mad chase around the rink. I don't think my hat ever got stolen. I remember one night when John Coleman, the big man on ice, was there. He was a couple years older than I, and due to an early growth spurt, towered over all the other boys. He was reputed to be the star of the 8th grade boys' hockey team due to a great slap shot. He clearly was in command of the evening, and at one point in the middle of pom-pom, he herded everyone to center ice and instructed us all to kneel on the red line. He then skated slowly by, and we eagerly tried to kiss his skates, as requested. What little information we knew about sex was also traded on those evenings. I remember one triumphant moment when I was able to tell the very cool Colt Landreth what a pervert was. Hot cocoa was served, but there was also one of those great water fountains that seemed to have the coldest water, and we all hypothesized that the water came straight from the depths of Lake Michigan. Jostling in line for water became something of a social event. However, I generally preferred to drink when no one else was around, since I had this fear, hopefully irrational, that the person standing in line behind me would smash my face into the basin, breaking all my teeth as I bent over to drink. There was a cramped girls' locker room just inside the entrance where you could go to regroup, renew hopes, and strategize. I remember one Friday in particular where we were saying goodbye to one of our friends, Barbara Crawford, I think, who was on the brink of moving out of town. Three or four of us gathered together in one of the moldy bathroom stalls with our arms around each other and simultaneously touched our tongues together, substituting saliva for a blood oath of eternal friendship. The Winter Club gym was also the site of our first organized social events, dancing school with Mrs. Wilson, a large matronly woman who taught us how to waltz and foxtrot. Her assistant thumped away on an out-of-tune piano, and Mrs. Wilson used a clicker in her hand to let the woman know when to start and stop. Some of the boys used to bring clickers and put them in their shoes to sabotage her signaling method. We started dancing school in sixth grade, and all the girls wore bobby socks and white gloves. During the ensuing months, girls would abruptly show up wearing stockings, which involved getting equipped with cumbersome garter belts. Nobody wanted to be the last girl wearing bobby socks, a fate that I narrowly escaped because I forgot to tell my neighbor Helen Reed that I had gone over to the other side. Dancing school is full of anxiety for most girls, since part of the cruel experience was that the girls had to wait for the boys to ask them to dance. The possibilities in order of humiliation were, 1, no one would ask you to dance, 2, a loser would ask you to dance, or 3, since there were more girls than boys, Mrs. Wilson would insist that the leftover girls dance with each other. There were also some dances over the holidays, and I think some of the parents thought they could engineer out the inequities by having a card dance. What a boneheaded move. Each girl was given a card with a dozen or more lines representing each dance of the evening, and the idea was that during the dinner party beforehand, boys would come up and sign up for a dance. Someone had also appointed the cool boys as the dance captains, which empowered them to demand to see your card. Rob Isham saw plenty of blank lines when he glanced at mine and said, a little too loudly, I thought, "I will need to take your card to get it filled." With that, he whisked it away and went to some back room and horse-traded with the other captains to get the card in some sort of respectable shape. He managed to get some of the dances filled. I guess he wasn't a miracle worker, and I regretfully noted that the critical last dance at midnight remained blank. I remember having a reasonable time at the dance, and then all of a sudden they turned on the lights for the last dance. I felt like I was in a game of musical chairs, except I had lost when the music started instead of stopped. There were a bunch of other girls without partners, and we all trooped over and sat down on the benches at the side of the gym. As I review these words, I realize it might sound like I had a tortured childhood, stigmatized by social awkwardness and dashed hopes to be part of the co-ed elite. But the truth was that I really didn't care and look back on those years with fond bemusement. Certainly, dancing school improved with the retirement of Mrs. Wilson and her thumping accomplice, replaced by Gus Giordano and a record player. Giordano was a young man with tight pants who ran a jazz dance studio and taught us dances like the Frug and the Swim. These dances set us free of the tyranny of the waltz, which absolutely required a partner, into freeform dances where you could dance with everybody or no one. These memories were especially vivid as I drove our 13-year-old son to his first organized dance. "How does the system work, Ned?" I asked. "Do you ask the girls to dance, or do people dance in groups?" He just rolled his eyes at me. I pressed ahead. "You know, you might see some girls who look like they might want to dance. Why don't you just go ahead and ask them to join you? You know, it's not really fair that girls have to wait for boys to ask them to dance." Ned looked at me with horrified eyes. "I don't want to dance with a loser," he said. I did not know how the social caste system worked in sixth grade, but I guess that I was secretly pleased that at least he did not consider himself a loser. And to give myself some credit, I did not consider myself a loser in sixth grade. But seizing the teachable moment, I said, "You know, I was a loser, and it would have been nice if someone had asked me to dance occasionally." Ned was now truly horrified. My mother was a loser? I nodded my head, and I sensed that he suddenly realized that half of his genetic material was tainted by a self-confessed loser. "Oh, no! For how many years were you a loser?" he asked. I was pleased to note that Ned either thought I was no longer a loser or acknowledged that people's perceptions should not be frozen in time, a thought that had not occurred to me in sixth grade. And then finally, Ned said, "Did Dad rescue you from being a loser?" Although sexist, I did like his image of his father as the triumphant white knight swooping down to rescue his bride from social obscurity, so I nodded yes. At this point, we had arrived to pick up his friend J.D. He burst into the house and loudly announced to both J.D. and his mother, "I can't believe it! My mother was a loser!" I turned to wink at the mother, hoping that she would join me in sisterly solidarity for all losers, but I got no reaction. I had only met her once before when we had first moved to town and she came to pick up J.D. at our house. She had wandered to the backyard and saw me bouncing on the trampoline as I showed the boys a fabulous game of dodgeball I had invented. I distinctly remember wearing my favorite old ripped t-shirt that illustrated different birds of prey and a pair of ratty green shorts. She, on the other hand, was wearing an impeccable pair of snug white pants, a green and pink shirt, and was holding a handbag. I detected a judgmental look then and saw the same expression now as Ned's announcement confirmed her first impression.